The work group was then formed, and Timothy Travis of the Oregon Judicial Department agreed to be its chair, and with a significant investment of time, the work group produced the recommendations to you that are embodied in House Bill 2127. And I've noted in my written testimony there the membership of the work group, noting that it included representatives from Oregon DOJ, the Judicial Department, the Youth Authority, the Juvenile Department Directors Association, the Oregon District Attorneys Association, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, the Oregon Office of Public Defense Services, the Juvenile Rights Project, and the Crime Victims United. Senior Assistant Attorney General Kamala Sugar from the Department of Justice, and together with Mr. Travis, will be walking the committee through the provisions of the bill, and will be reviewing certain amendments that the work group is further recommending to you after its additional review of the draft of the measure as it emerged from Legislative Council. Most of the provisions of this bill are consensus recommendations of the work group to the Legislative Assembly. But some of the provisions are not. And I believe that all points of disagreement within the work group will be made clear for the committee in the course of your considering it. And with any amendments that the committee decides to make after completing your consideration of the measure, I very sincerely hope the committee will recommend passage of this measure as an important part of Oregon's total effort to ensure compliance with crime victims' rights in Oregon. Mr. Chair, thank you very much. With that, I'm going to conclude my remarks, and if it's agreeable to you and the committee, hand over the further presentation to my colleague, Ms. Sugar, and to Mr. Travis.
Well, thank you very much, Attorney General Myers, for making that those introductory remarks. Any questions for the Attorney General before he departs? Thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning. I'm Timothy Travis. I'm with the Oregon Judicial Department. I'm staff counsel for juvenile courts and for treatment courts, drug courts, and the like. excuse me. I got involved in this when our criminal law analyst took a new job and I had to babysit the Crime Victims Task Force. And as I did that, at the same time I was doing that, I pro tem judge in juvenile court around the state. And my awareness through the Crime Victims Task Force of the growing scrutiny that would exist in our system in regard to crime victims' rights made my experience on the bench tell me that we had some work to do. It was apparent to me that in the juvenile code, there were places where it would be very difficult to figure out exactly who was supposed to do what in terms of victims' rights, because the juvenile system is different than the adult system, and the two don't necessarily operate the same way. For example, the constitutional rights for victims include the right to be informed and supported by the district attorney. In the juvenile system, the district attorney touches a minority of the cases. Therefore, it would be difficult in looking through the juvenile system to figure out exactly who was supposed to do this for victims. There are also some contradictions between the crime victims' rights that are in the Constitution and some provisions in the juvenile code. The juvenile code has been around for a good long time. It predates the crime victims' rights in the Constitution. An example of this is that in the Constitution, victims are entitled to a copy of any court transcript that is prepared. The juvenile code holds that transcripts in delinquency cases are confidential. From the point of view of the Judicial Department, these vaguenesses, ambiguities, and contradictions meant hearings. It meant that we were going to have arguments in court over how we were going to actualize these rights within the juvenile system. We didn't want to have those hearings because, first of all, those hearings take up time, and second of all, they run the risk of inconsistent decisions around the state. So it was our view that what we really needed to do was we needed to take the juvenile code and explicitly integrate crime victims' rights into it in much the same way that had already been done with the criminal code previously. So as Mr. Myers pointed out, we went to the Law Commission. It was simply too late, given their workload, for us to do this under the auspices of the Law Commission, which is where this work naturally might have been done. We had a work group over the summer that Mr. Myers sponsored. We pulled together all the people he talked about. We sat around, and we tried to figure out how it was that we would do this. And we came to, as Mr. Myers said, a consensus about exactly how we could explicitly put things in there that would give direction to people about how we were supposed to actualize crime victims' rights and to straighten out things so that it would be clear to everyone. There will be people, there were people, during the course of this process who believed that what eventually came into House Bill 2127 exceeded the constitutional minimum for what we minimally had to do in terms of providing for victims' rights within the Constitution. We decided as a consensus that that was not so. There were also people who had ideas about how we could put things in the juvenile code which would go beyond the constitutional minimum and that would be good for victims. We decided that our task was to create a structure within the juvenile code that clarified who was supposed to do what and that removed contradictions. If the legislature, as the policy-making body, wishes to go beyond the constitutional minimum, that is certainly the legislature's prerogative. We believe that what we have brought you does create a structure within the juvenile code which will actualize crime victims' rights, make clear who's supposed to do what, and provide the support and encouragement that's necessary to make crime victims' rights a reality in delinquency cases. As some of you have heard me say in the past, I do my best work under the supervision of responsible women. That is why Ms. Sugar is going to do the heavy lifting of walking you through the bill, and I will be here to provide, what do they call it in football, color commentary.
Ms. Sugar, please identify yourself for the record.
Chair McPherson and members of the committee, my name is Kamala Sugar. I am an assistant attorney in charge at the Department of Justice, and I'm pleased to be here today to walk you through House Bill 2127. The constitutional victims' rights that were passed as part of ballot measure 40 were never codified into the juvenile code. This means that when victims appear in juvenile court in one county, they may actually enjoy exercising those rights, but in another county, they may not. The codification of those rights seemed, as Mr. Travis indicated, very appropriate given the other considerations of victims' rights that are being made. Article 1, Sections 42, 43, and 44 are where you will find those constitutional rights. The bill primarily focuses on giving victims the right, or affording the victims the right, upon request, to be notified and have the opportunity to be heard at a critical stage of the juvenile delinquency proceeding. Victims in juvenile cases are not unique. They are victims of a crime, just like victims of an adult crime. And they suffer the same trauma and experiences that a victim of an adult crime would, and often find themselves frustrated when they attempt to exercise their rights to be heard. The process in juvenile cases, as Mr. Travis pointed out, is different. And because of that, the obligation to notify the victims is shared in this proposed legislation with the district attorney and the juvenile department to ensure that the victim does get notified, because there are hearings, many hearings, where the district attorney does not appear. But the juvenile department probation officer will appear and has the opportunity to notify the victim. The critical stages of the proceedings are listed in the bill in Section 2. I won't go through and read them all to you, but you can see that they sound different than what you might be familiar with in a criminal court. And for that reason, they've been listed as opposed to referred to generally as they are in the constitutional provision. There are many hearings that occur in a juvenile proceeding that are not not necessarily a hearing that you would think would cause a victim to want to appear. And yet, because the court is always reviewing the probationary status of a youth and trying to decide whether to continue that probationary status or send that youth to another correctional-type facility, sometimes victims do want to appear at those hearings, and that's why you'll see hearings to review placement, hearings to set or change conditions of release, hearings to transfer proceedings, and hearings such as those. In Section 3 of the bill, a series of victims' rights that you will find, these are not necessarily constitutional rights, these are a series of rights that you will find in the adult criminal code. One of the other efforts in this measure is to bring the rights that victims enjoy in the adult criminal code into compliance in the juvenile code. These are rights such as the right not to speak to the youth offender's attorney unless the victim wishes to, is informed of who they're talking with, the right not to speak to an investigator, the right to have their address and other information kept confidential from the offender. And in the instance when the youth offender is released, the right to have a no-contact provision in that release agreement so that there will be no contact with the victim pending trial, pending the hearing. Further, if there is contact and that contact is intimidating or threatening, this bill provides for a hearing for the court to decide whether that victim, that youth offender, needs to be placed back in detention. Section 11 of this bill is another section that I think it's important to discuss, because that section allows, and let me back up, the Constitution allows for a victim to be consulted with regard to plea negotiations upon request in certain circumstances. And this bill does allow for that. One of the things that our work group discussed at length was whether in the juvenile arena, a formal accountability agreement would have that same effect. And it is, and to explain to those of you that are not familiar with juvenile law, a formal accountability agreement is a pre-charging diversion, the best way I can explain it. Instead of charging the youth, the juvenile department and the youth enter into an agreement whereby the youth completes a certain set of conditions. It could include community service work. It could include rehabilitative treatment. And it could include some payment of restitution to the victim. In the case where there is a violent felony involved, this bill allows for the victim to be consulted prior to entry into one of those agreements. And I'd be happy to answer questions if you have more on that matter.
I would just point out that the victim has the right to be consulted in plea negotiations, and this is an analog of that right when you don't have a plea because you don't have a petition filed. It's ensuring that the victim understands what's going on. Very frequently, victims become tootsed when they find out that charges that have been filed on their behalf are compromised or plea bargained, and this provision is there to give the victim a voice in that process.
The last section I wanted to discuss were the sections that deal with the release of the offender and the pretrial detention of the offender. The constitutional provision that this is related to is Section 43, Article 1, Section 43, Section 1A, the right of the victim to be reasonably protected from the youth offender throughout the pendency of the proceedings. And the idea here is that youth offenders have a certain criteria with which they can be held in detention and a list of criteria that the court will consider upon their release. And this is currently in the juvenile code. However, and that's at 419C 145 and 153. However, the juvenile court right now is not required to consider the reasonable safety and protection of the victim in making those decisions, nor is the juvenile department required to consider the reasonable protection of the victim in making the decision to detain the youth. And so this is simply adding that as a factor among many that will be considered by the court and the juvenile department in deciding whether to release the youth or not. I would be happy to entertain questions, and that concludes my testimony on behalf of the Department of Justice. I would like to thank all of our partners that participated in the work group, the Oregon Youth Authority, the District Attorneys, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, the Juvenile Rights Project, Crime Victims United, and the Oregon Judicial Department. Specifically, we would like to thank Mr. Travis for his hard work on drafting the initial versions of this bill. Thank you.
I would just like to add that this is an extremely important piece of legislation, not only for the reasons that I pointed out earlier, that it gives guidance to people in the juvenile system as to who's supposed to do what. This entire effort around the Crime Victims Task Force has to do with maintaining the integrity of our system in the eyes of the citizenry. It is extremely important that the citizens of the state of Oregon believe that the law will be followed. Now, I lived through a period of time in the mid-90s in which a great many citizens in the state of Oregon lost faith in the juvenile system because they came to see, rightly or wrongly, that the juvenile system did not take seriously the effects of juvenile crime on our society. And because the citizens of the state of Oregon, a great number of them, came to believe that that was the case, we saw a reaction which changed the face of juvenile law in Oregon. Measure 11 and Senate Bill 1 in the mid-90s changed the entire context of juvenile law. It is extremely important at this point in history that the court system, the juvenile system, the prosecutors, all of us involved, make the public understand that we are dedicated to following the law, whether some of us like it or not. Because if we lose the faith of the people of the state of Oregon, we are undermining the pillars of our republic. It's extremely important that this work. Thank you.
Representative Kump.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. I want to share just one comment and then one question. My sincere, deep appreciation as a school administrator in dealing with youth from the ages of 11 on up that have been victimized, and there has not been justice. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart, because many, many families have gone through terrible situations without feeling the support of the system. So this is, you are so right. I applaud your work. It makes my heart sing to know that these victims will see some things happening. And my only question of concern is because my district is in a part of the state where we have a tremendous amount of bilingual people. In particular, I have dealt with Hispanic young girls, and they come from Mexico and don't understand why, you know, when uncle molests them, that we press charges. And to explain that to them in English does not do much good. So I'm curious about what sort of support you have for victims that are not of our Anglo culture.
Chair McPherson, Representative Kump, that is a growing problem around our state, communicating with victims who do not speak English. And from my understanding, the majority of district attorney's offices have a victim advocate who works in their office who is able to communicate with victims, and many of them are beginning to hire bilingual advocates. If they don't have someone on staff who's a paid advocate who speaks another language, they at least try to bring in volunteers who work for their victim services program who can communicate with victims who are bilingual.
Follow-ups. And beyond explaining the law, the critical need is the explanation of the difference of culture. Because even with our Russian old believers in our Latino culture, there's an acceptance of certain forms of abuse that aren't reported. So they don't understand why some of us as, public servants do report these things. So that misunderstanding of our Constitution is very complicated.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your work. I have a question about what you explained as a shared obligation. And I noticed it a couple times in the bill, and I also noticed in the amendments that are pending, the shared responsibility between the district attorney and the juvenile department. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit, I anticipate this, well, I didn't tell him because I thought you did. Well, we thought you did. And I talk a little bit about practically how that works, because it doesn't say, it just says district attorney or juvenile department. So how do we have the confidence in knowing that the information is getting to where it's supposed to get when it doesn't say who? It just says between the two entities, somebody is supposed to do that. So I'd like to hear a little bit about practically how the assurance is going to be, that we can be assured that it's going to work with that ambiguity.
That's really a very good question, because, as I said, the district attorney is not involved in every single case. And as you know, victims will be getting a card. Each victim will be getting a card at the scene, and there will be the number of the district attorney's office and the juvenile department. One of the problems that we had to face in this was the fact that the juvenile departments, frankly, are going to be looking at work. They're going to be looking at an increase in the amount of work they have to do if they are exclusively responsible for doing the notification. District attorneys are already tooled up around the state with victims' advocates and such, and resources, and it is our hope that those resources will be increased. You'll be finding out about them as the session wears on through Ways and Means and such. But they already have the structure in place, the procedures, the telephones, everything set up. The idea is that the district attorney and the juvenile departments will work very closely together to ensure that they will sort out on the local level who is supposed to do what. Because, as you know, in Oregon we have 36 counties and 47 ways of doing things. And it's very important that you not go out to Baker County and say, "Hi, I'm from Salem, and this is how you're going to do it." Believe me, I've learned that working with the courts. But to give them the responsibility to work out where the lines are, who's going to do what on the local level. If that doesn't work, if there's a problem with that, we're going to know about it real quick. Because, like I said, every victim is going to get a card. And not only is there the district attorney's phone number on that, and not only is there the juvenile department's phone number on that, there's a phone number in Salem that they can call to say, "Hey, this ain't working out for me." So we think that we have the ability to let the local level determine what they're going to do. And at the same time, we have a check to make sure that if they don't do it, we have feedback so that we can fix the system. I should point out also that this cooperation between the juvenile department and the district attorney's office is not something that's going to be created simply for this project. The district attorney and the juvenile departments do work together in every county right now. They always have, and especially since the passage of Senate Bill 1, where there's coordination sometimes about how to charge things and those kinds of issues, they do work together right now. So we're confident that we can say "and or" so that we're not trying to dictate one size fits all, and that we're feeding into a system that already works in terms of cooperation between the two agencies.
Thank you.
Any further questions? I've just one, I think, for you, Mr. Travis. If I understood your opening remarks, there, at least in the view of some participants in the work group, the bill goes beyond what is constitutionally required. Is that your view, that it in some respects it does? And if so, what are those respects?
I don't think it goes beyond what's constitutionally required, but I'm not wearing a black robe right now. I think it's more important for you to hear from the people who hold those views than it would be to hear from me. because they can articulate their point of view better than I can. I personally am confident that this does what we set out to do, which was to animate victims' rights within the juvenile code.
Chair McPherson, if I could.
Ms. Sugar, please.
Thank you. Chair McPherson, members of the committee, I did identify Section 3 of the bill, which does take the concepts that are in the adult criminal code and apply them to the juvenile code. There may be some argument that that goes beyond what's constitutionally required as a bare minimum, but it is bringing them into compliance with what's already happening for victims of adult crime. And I don't think it's outside the scope of the work group or the intention of the bill. Further, when one takes some time to look at the constitutional provisions, all of this is intended to ensure the reasonable safety and protection of the victim, which is a constitutional requirement. And so to that end, it's consistent with the Constitution.
And I should say, Chair McPherson, I'm sorry, I don't think anybody is arguing that anything is unconstitutional. I think some people are saying it goes.
No, I understand that. It's a question of whether it is, whether we are making policy choices that go beyond what we would be directed to do by our Constitution. That's
right.
Really the issue.
And as far as the Judicial Department is concerned, we don't make policy. You make policy. We carry out policy. That's separation of powers. And if there was something in here that I thought went beyond the proper role of the Judicial Department, I would be telling you that this morning. As far as I'm concerned, there's no policy being made in this. Policy is being realized in this.
Mm-hmm. Chair McPherson, the other piece that I pointed out earlier were the formal accountability agreements and the analysis as to whether those, because they are pre-adjudicatory, fall under the purview of consulting a victim with regard to plea negotiations. But because there isn't a charge and there isn't a plea, but if one successfully completes this pre-charging agreement, the charges go away. So it was our intention to give victims a voice in that decision-making process, as they would be afforded if there were a charge and a plea deal. That is the only other point I think that may be raised later that our work group struggled with, but decided that because it is such a serious thing to completely do away with a conviction or the potential of being charged, even when there's let me back up. The juvenile department probation officer has to decide that there's probable cause to charge the youth in order to require the youth to enter into this agreement. So there's enough to charge the person, but it isn't formally charged. The victim then would have, in this legislation, would have the right to be consulted as a part of making that decision. And that is in our view, similar to a plea bargain or a plea agreement.
Not to prolong this, but you know, the policy behind saying that victims have the right to be consulted when there's a violent crime, the policy is that when you're going to compromise, that the victim should know that and have a voice in that. And it's my view that whether you're going to compromise in a technical plea negotiation or you're going to compromise at some earlier stage in the process, the policy doesn't care if it's plea negotiations. The policy cares that the victim's charges are being compromised. And if the victim's charges are being compromised, then it seems to me the policy is the victim ought to be involved in that. We got to get beyond the labels and get down to what we're trying to accomplish. Mm-hmm. We're trying to accomplish integrity in the system and respect for victims.
Any other questions for this panel? Then thank you very much. Next we have Steve Dole from Crime Victims United. It looks like we have Ken Chapman on the sign-up list. I assume that's you, Mr. Chapman?
That's correct.
Very good. Mr. Holmes, proceed ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Dole. I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon. Again, I want to congratulate the chair on his appointment as chair of House Judiciary. And as I told him earlier, this is the first time in 12, maybe it was 14 years that I've had a fellow citizen, neighbor, and my rep chairing a committee. And in fact, the time before that this happened, 12, 14 years ago, that rep chaired this committee. I think it was actually a subcommittee at the time of criminal law of the judiciary.
You can rely that I'm looking after your interests and the other 57,000 residents of the district.
Thank you. Crime Victims United is strongly supportive of this bill. I have to tell you that I want to thank the Attorney General for all of his work and for letting us participate in developing the bill itself. And I also want to publicly thank Timothy Travis for all his hard work on this bill. I personally got involved in the crime victims movement because of a juvenile crime, as many of you know, murder of my daughter in 1992 by a juvenile. So I've been very involved since that time as part of my overall involvement in the crime victims movement and the issues around crime as a advisory member of the Oregon Youth Authority, and I've been on that advisory group since the OYA's inception. We were on committees, and I personally served on committees and subcommittees for Senate Bill 1, which changed the juvenile code in Oregon in 1995 through the legislature. Our organization, Crime Victims United, was responsible in the 80s for the first Victims' Rights Bill, Measure 8, that failed in 1984, and then Measure 10, which was a statutory provision that passed overwhelmingly by the citizens in 1986, and then we brought, and I was very involved in Measure 40, which was passed by the people of Oregon, overwhelmingly the constitutional rights for crime victims, and then, of course, was repassed by the people in the state of Oregon in 1999 after it was thrown out by the courts on a technicality in 1998. So that's a little bit about where we've come from as Crime Victims United as far as crime victims' rights goes and the juvenile portion of the criminal justice system. I'm actually Tim Travis stole a little bit of my thunder. He's absolutely right when he says that, you know, the juvenile portion of the criminal justice system was in complete disarray in the early and mid-90s, and it had completely spun out of control, and that's why we got Senate Bill 1, and that's why the people of the state of Oregon, by 67%, passed Measure 11, and overwhelmingly was reaffirmed by almost 75% in the year 2000. So with that, I'm not going to belabor this, but I would like to introduce someone. We're very happy to have a gentleman who's worked very closely with Crime Victims United for the last 10 or 12 years, and his name is Mr. Ken Chapman. He's sitting to my left. Ken is a gentleman who's we've turned to for the last 10 to 12 years whenever something... When we're dealing with the juvenile code and juvenile law. His experiences as a parole and probation officer in Jackson County, where he worked as a probation officer and also as a supervisor for over 35 years. And he retired this last year. And as Al Pacino said, just when I thought I was getting out, they pulled me back in. So that's what we did with Mr. Chapman, and I'm going to turn it over to him for him to testify on the bill, because he really sat on the committee and did most of the work for us on this particular piece of legislation, and I thank you for your attention.
Good. Mr. Chapman.
Chairman McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Ken Chapman, and I testify representing Crime Victims United. I want to thank the Attorney General and the task force that worked on this for coming up with what I think is a very comprehensive approach to providing access for victims in the juvenile justice system. Most of the provisions here are measures to ease the access for victims. In my work as a probation officer and as a supervisor, I often dealt with victims who felt confused, angry. But one of the comments I had from a victim was they felt like they were kind of an oh, by the way, footnote in the judicial proceedings. That's not intentional. I understand that in the press of business, it's hard to factor in those things, everything. But making it explicit in the law helps. And this will greatly help victims to feel an actual part of the system and not somebody who kind of needs sharp elbows to get in and have reasonable input. While we agree with all of the provisions in this bill, there's three I want to bring up to you that I think provide some real progress. The first is it allows victim safety to be factored into decisions on pre-adjudicatory detention. As you may be aware, juvenile law is restrictive on the issue of detention. In adult law, people can be booked into jail and booked out with bail. In juvenile law, only felonies and only under some circumstances and also assault can be lodged in detention. Nowhere in the list of factors to be considered for pre-adjudicatory detention has it mentioned the reasonable safety of the victim. This adds that, and I think it is an important improvement in current law. Then for those who are either not lodged in detention but brought in and immediately released, or those who are released by the court, it does mandate a no-contact order with the victim. It also provides a procedure for, which I think is very well written, to deal with cases that involve intimidation or threats toward the victim. At the point when that is proven, based on the standard of proof which is in the bill, the victim's considerations become paramount. And under some considerations, juveniles can be kept in detention until their trial. The third is one which has been mentioned previously, and that is a provision to be consulted in some circumstances for violent felonies for a formal accountability agreement. You may not be aware, but of, let's say, of every 100 cases that are sent to a juvenile department, only 18 statewide would end up in court. So we have most cases not going to court, and many cases being dealt with through a formal accountability agreement. So when that happens, as been mentioned previously, it is certainly appropriate for the victim to at least be consulted prior to the signing of the agreement. The other thing to keep in mind, I think, is that in the juvenile system, the emphasis really is on rehabilitation. And Crime Victims United agrees with that completely. But sometimes when you're dealing with when you're dealing with what is going to help an offender most, it's easy to overlook the reasonable concerns and the rights and prerogatives of victims. This in no way diminishes at all the rehabilitative goal of the juvenile justice system, but it certainly puts victims in there to be consulted. While we don't see this as answering every question that victims might have about the system, we do want to congratulate the task force for having a very comprehensive approach to this, and we would urge passage of it. And I'd be more than happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Chapman. Are there any questions for either Mr. Dole or Mr. Chapman? See no questions then, gentlemen, so thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, may I a final comment, a clarification on a couple of things. I want to say this. It's actually in the first paragraph of the testimony that I want to make sure that you understand that this bill does not expand crime victims' rights. It merely ensures that the victims are given notice and the opportunity to participate. And let's not forget that within the juvenile system, that within the OYA today, the Oregon Youth Authority, that has province over adjudicated youth, both those who are adjudicated, the small group that are adjudicated within the adult system, either through Measure 11 or through court waiver, and the vast amount who are adjudicated as a juvenile, that there's about roughly today 850 kids who are under in secure facilities in the state of Oregon, but about 19,000 kids who have committed crimes are out on our streets under the purview of the counties. So the vast amount of kids, and we don't advocate that we lock them all up. That's not the point. But I want to make sure that you understand that's the way the juvenile system works. As to Mr. Chair, if I may, Representative Comp had a question, a very valid one, about this issue of communicating with the minorities in our communities, and the victims. Rights Compliance Group, which is a separate group which is looking at overall compliance in both the juvenile and the adult system. That's part of their task, and they are printing they are in the throes of putting together pamphlets, brochures, posters, etc., to communicate with those minority communities. One other thing that I would like to address, Mr. Chair, is that one of the things that would help with this whole issue of the rights of victims in when there's a juvenile who's committed the crime, and that is the additional funding of victims advocates that are specialists in the area of juvenile crime, and that are assigned to the district attorney's offices. District attorneys, as you know, most district attorneys, not all, have victim advocates within their office, and we want to make sure that those advocate offices are fully funded, and that hopefully we have an advocate in there that specializes, or in the small counties that has training and specializing in juvenile crime.
I appreciate the comment, Mr. Dole. As you know, we're not a budget committee, we're a policy committee. So,
right. I understand.
I think we have a question from Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just before this panel leaves, I note in Ms. Sugar's prepared comments that there were five pending consensus amendments, and do I understand then that Crime Victims United is supportive of the amendments that are being crafted as well?
I'm going to defer to Mr. Chapman.
Well, Crime Victims United would go along with consensus, yes.
Thank you.
Amy Miller is the next on our witness list. Ms. Miller.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. Good morning, everyone. I'm a wee bit nervous. This is my first time in front of this distinguished panel, so forgive me for perhaps rushing or stumbling over my words. Thank you for allowing me to talk to you today. My name is Amy Miller, and I'm a staff attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project. JRP is a law firm that represents and advocates for children and youth in Oregon. And more specifically, we represent several thousand children and youth involved in the child welfare and juvenile justice system by court appointment each year. JRP has provided testimony and technical assistance to committees and members of the legislature in every session since our inception in 1976. I'm here today to discuss our concerns regarding House Bill 2127. The rights of victims are extremely important to our organization because many of our clients came to become our clients because they were victims of physical or sexual abuse, neglect, and other crimes. As background information, and you've heard this today already, JRP was pleased to be part of the work group which drafted this legislative proposal. As you know, the task which the group was charged with undertaking was to incorporate the constitutional provisions relating to victims' rights into the Juvenile Code. However, some of our comments were not included in House Bill 2127, and as a result, JRP has three primary concerns regarding this bill, all related to interpretation. First, Sections of this bill exceed the scope of the victims' rights provided for in the Constitution. For example, Section 3, sub 5b states that if the court finds the victim has been threatened or intimidated by direct or indirect contact, a youth or youth offender may be held in detention. Under HB 2127, a youth or youth offender could be held in pretrial detention for minor contact with the victim, regardless of whether the victim's safety was at issue. The Constitution provides only for reasonable protection from the youth or youth offender throughout the delinquency process. Although this work group was not charged with making policy decisions regarding victims' rights, HB 2127 broadens existing constitutional provisions. Second, Section 15, sub 1G, which allows for pretrial detention of a youth for the reasonable protection of the victim, is not needed. ORS 419C-145 is already broad enough to allow an alleged youth offender to be detained in almost every conceivable situation where victim safety could be at issue. In addition, reducing the amount of time youth spend in detention has been shown to have a real positive impact on youth, as well as reduce recidivism in the community. And I've attached, for your reading, a study from the Casey Foundation, which shows that even brief periods of detention have long-lasting and really detrimental consequences for youth, including negative impacts on education and employment. Last, Section 19, sub 3, which provides a victim the right to be consulted regarding a formal accountability agreement involving an alleged act, which, if committed by an adult, would be a violent felony, is inapplicable. FAAs are contracts between the youth and the juvenile department. They are not the same as a plea. Because FAAs are not plea negotiations, the constitutional provision which grants victims the right to be consulted regarding plea negotiations involving a violent felony does not apply. Thank you so much for your consideration of our comments today, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Ms. Miller, if you could go back to the first of those comments. I didn't get the reference down, and I have to confess I didn't quite absorb it. I think I got the other two. But if you could take me back to the first, you went to Section 15, 1G, and 19, sub 3.
Chair McPherson, the first thing, and it's in my written testimony that you have under, it's number one at the bottom of the first page. It's related to Section 3, sub 5B, which I think is page 3, line 13. And it talks about if the court finds that the victim has been threatened or intimidated by direct or indirect contact, a youth or youth offender may be held in detention. And we believe that this exceeds the scope of the constitutional provision. And think maybe what would be more accurate is amending this section to provide for detention when necessary to protect the safety of the victim, which is what the Constitution alludes to.
Okay. Any questions for the witness? We included in the written testimony from the Department of Justice from Ms. Sugar was a description of some consensus amendments, which apparently don't go to the issues that you've identified. And are you okay with those consensus amendments?
Chair McPherson, yes, we are, and I participated in that conversation as well.
Right. And would it be a fair characterization? Well, let me ask about you, for you to comment on what the department told us, which is that essentially this bill is reflecting the same policy choices that have been made in the adult setting and is applying them in the juvenile setting. Would you disagree with that characterization?
Chair McPherson, I don't know that I'm as familiar with the adult section as I could be to make that a characterization. However, I do know that there is a distinction between the adult criminal code and the juvenile code because some of the objectives behind it are different. So therefore, I think it's very important to consider whenever incorporating provisions from the criminal code.
Okay. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question, please, about the third issue that you raised about the formal accountability agreement. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the circumstance. What are the juveniles charged with typically when they're brought into that situation to negotiate a formal accountability agreement? I just want to understand a little bit more about the circumstances under which that would come up, because I see you're saying that there's a distinction between a formal accountability agreement and a plea agreement.
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, I don't have my code book in front of me, so I can't read to you the exact sections which allow formal accountability agreements to be issued, but they're rarely issued in the case of a violent felony because district attorney approval is normally required, and so generally, from my experience, a district attorney in most cases would not approve that. In Multnomah County, I can only speak to what I'm familiar with. So for the most part, they're for first time offenses and less serious offenses would be the types of with the idea being that this youth is able to make an agreement with the juvenile department and doesn't require formal adjudication.
Representative Barker.
I want to comment. When you start out, you said that a lot of those people, a lot of the juveniles, are victims of crime and so on. And I think the vote that we took last year to make Jessica's Law, put Jessica's Law in law, is trying to prevent some of that. And I understand that you get damaged. So a lot of those juveniles get in trouble or damaged from other things. But I don't know that that gives them permission to commit those crimes. I don't hear you saying that, but I mean, there's this implication I've heard in the last few days where, gee, this poor victim, because he didn't get to a head start or something. And I'm concerned about the victim of the present crime. And on the regarding the plea, one of the problems is, at least from my perspective, is people don't feel their part. Victims don't feel they have any say. Things are done. They don't know what's going on. And in reality, they don't have much of a say even when they're participating, but at least they're participating. And I really feel that's important. And we see these things saying, well, this is juvenile, so it's really not the same. I know there's a division, and I know the emphasis is on rehabilitation. I'm all for that, but this is like those same kind of thing. I mean, comparable to adult. And I'm a strong supporter, from what I can see, these that victims of these crimes do need to be in that system. And I don't find your argument persuasive to me. And if there's a threat, shouldn't the criminal, juvenile, whatever, but the person who's making those, shouldn't they be held accountable? I mean, I don't want them out. If they're out there saying, you know, if you continue to push this, I'm going to get you or something or whatever, especially if it's a victim of violent crime, the victim needs to be protected.
Chair McPherson, Representative Barker, you're absolutely correct. Our concern is that it would allow for detention if there was a threat or intimidation by direct or indirect contact. And so, for example, there are situations where you could be intimidated, but it might not be an unsafe situation for the victim. And that's the distinction that we're trying to draw, which is why we believe that the bill goes beyond the scope of the Constitution and would recommend that it say something such as allowing for detention when necessary to protect the safety of the victim, because that is what's reflected in the Constitution.
Mr. Chair.
If I may, Mr. Chair. But you have a judge in the middle of that. I mean, it isn't like I say, gee, I feel threatened, and they say, okay, lock the guy up. That's not going to happen. A judge is going to review and say, why do you feel threatened? What's going on? So I think there are safeguards in there. I mean, to me, I see safeguards in the system as it stands. Thank you.
Representative Cameron.
Just as a follow-up to Representative Barker, can you give me an example of a threat that's been made that, as a victim, I may not feel threatened?
Chairman Pearson, Representative Cameron, that's a great question and one I pondered as I was trying to think about what questions I might have to answer today. Indirect contact, I believe, would include email. So perhaps it could be an email from someone that lived across town, which might not implicate safety. Those were the types of things I was considering in my head. That would be an example. And Representative Barker did make the point that there would be a court hearing as well.
Any further questions?
I just had a scenario running through my head. Can I run a scenario across
please,
the board?
Cup, please.
Okay, we have a young youth in a middle school that has totally admitted of doing abuse to sexual abuse to peers. And so in the past, what we've had to do as a school is to ensure the safety of the students who are still in the school and the safety of the predator. And so you talk about a mixed bag of rights. I've dealt with that challenge, and we didn't have a judge telling us which way would be best for all. And it was left up to us as a school institution to make sure all the students were safe and could still learn. And let me tell you, that was beyond anything I ever anticipated when I became a principal.
If there are no further questions, then thank you, Ms. Miller.
Thank you so much.
And because we have pending amendments that are being prepared to the bill, we won't be taking this one to work session today. So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2127. We've only dealt with one of the five bills that were noticed for today, and I've learned since we started our meeting, or at the start of our meeting, that two of our members have another meeting to go to at 10, and so it seems likely that we won't get entirely through this agenda. Is there anyone who has come from a distance present on any of the remaining four bills? Anybody who's from outside the Salem area, for example? And seeing that that's not the case, then I think we'll just proceed in order and see how far we get. So I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2132. And we have Tim Sylvester from the Department of Justice.
Good morning, Chairman McPherson, members of the committee. Perhaps I can be relatively speedy on this one. Excuse the pun. This is a relatively simple concept, and members of the committee may already be aware of the general issue. This is a bill that will change slightly a statute that governs a defendant's right to a dismissal for lack of a speedy trial. As a bit of background, we have, and I apologize for not having written testimony here with me today. We will be submitting some later on this morning or today. A defendant in a criminal action has a right to a speedy trial under both the state and federal constitution. Yeah, as far as the constitutional right, that will result in dismissal only in those circumstances in which there is actual prejudice to the defendant as a result of the delay. In addition to the constitutional provision, we have a series of statutes in the Oregon Criminal Code that in a variety of situations entitle the defendant to a speedy trial, and the very general statute is the one that is set out in this bill, and that's 135.747. As the bill currently is written, as the statute currently is written, if there is a substantial delay in the proceedings and there hasn't been a continuance on application of the defendant or with his consent, the court has authority to dismiss the charge. And although that seems like a salutary principle, over the recent years that has created a problem for prosecutors around the state with budget cuts, both with in law enforcement as far as execution of search of arrest warrants and other things like that, and also with respect to the courts having sufficient resources to handle the cases in a timely manner. And so there, over the recent past, there has been delays in actually prosecuting cases through no fault of the prosecutor, but because of problems with resources in both law enforcement and in judicial resources trying cases. And that, over the past several years, has resulted in a lot of dismissals around the state of criminal charges, again, when there was no fault of the prosecuting. authority. We had a series of cases decided by the Oregon Supreme Court a couple of years ago, State versus David, State versus Adams, and State versus Johnson, that pretty much strictly applied this statute to the result of the dismissal of criminal charges in those sorts of circumstances. And so our proposal here changes the statute slightly, but in a very significant manner. And that is that it still will require a dismissal if there has been a substantial delay. And again, if it hasn't been upon application of the defendant or with the consent of the defendant, but there will also be two additional requirements. And one is that the defendant has not willfully failed to appear at any point in the proceedings, and also that the defendant demonstrates that he has been substantially prejudiced by the delay that has occurred. And the first of those I want to point out is that it is unfortunately a common event that defendants will fail to appear at pretrial proceedings, causing delay in the process. And the courts have not always said that that particular delay is a legitimate excuse for the extended delay in the case, and may end up dismissing a case for that reason. Or they will say, well, the defendant's only responsible for the two-month delay when he failed to appear, and so we will take that out of the mix, but still the rest of the delay was substantial. And the point that we have there is that if a defendant in the course of a criminal proceeding is personally responsible for any significant delay in the case, then he should be not disentitled to any sort of speedy trial dismissal under the statute. The other thing that this statute does, and that's set forth in subsection 2, is that it's a bit uncertain at this point whether the lack of judicial resources for prompt litigation, for prompt trial of cases, is a factor that may be considered under this statute as a justifying a continuance and denial of dismissal. And the purpose of subsection 2 is simply to declare as a matter of policy that if the delay in the case is the result solely of the lack of judicial resources, there are not enough judges that day, that sort of thing, and so the case had to be continued one more time, that is something that will be taken into account in deciding whether a dismissal is appropriate. Again, the lack of judicial resources is not a sin to be visited upon the prosecutor in that situation. Unless the members of the committee have any questions, that's all I have prepared for this morning.
Are there any questions of Mr. Sylvester? I don't see any questions.
Thank you.
So thank you. We have now Amy Alconich from OCDLA.
Good morning, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Amy Alconich, and I'm working with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I'd like to address three broader points in terms of this bill. The first is that this statute was originally intended to be a housekeeping measure. The constitutional speedy trial requirements in some ways very much address a defendant's right to have their case heard swiftly. What this is meant to do is to make sure that cases do not languish in the system, that cases do not stay there, that judges and prosecutors and defense attorneys move the cases as quickly as possible through the system, so you do not have a backup, so you do not have a whole bunch of cases logging and clogging the system as we saw happen during the budget crisis. And I'm not sure what the committee at this point knows about how that time limit is calculated, but it's approximately 11 months, which is what case law has said is the outer boundary for how long a case can and should sit in the system. That computation is arrived at by deducting partially the amount of time that a defendant has been responsible for the delay. So if a defendant fails to appear or ask for setovers or has a settlement conference, any of those practical things that occur are not included in that computation. So the 11 months must be attributable either to the state, meaning the defense, either the DA, or some sort of judicial backlog. These requirements in House Bill 2132 are even more stringent than the requirements for the constitutional speedy trial. And I'm looking at specifically Section 1, subsection C, that says defendant must demonstrate that the defendant has been substantially prejudiced. As was pointed out in earlier testimony, the standard for constitutional speedy trial is only must be actually prejudiced, must show actual prejudice. That is a difference. I take it the way I read it, that a substantial prejudice is a higher standard than actual prejudice. The second point I would like to make is that this will have a significant, I think, kind of the reverse impact that was intended by the statute and will have a negative fiscal impact on the court system. The first is that the result is that a case can stay in the system much longer. And as the committee knows, the longer the case stays in the system, the more it costs the state to hold on to it. This will mean potentially additional hearings, additional DA time, additional judicial time, and additional defense attorney time. Consequently, when you have a motion on speedy trial based on the statutory requirements, you will have a much longer hearing, and that results in a cost to the state. Instead of having a hearing that may take 1 or 2 hours, to go through the computation, to have the DA and the defense attorney make an argument, you're looking at a situation where to prove these factors, the defense attorney and the state will potentially have to call witnesses, they'll have to make more in-depth arguments, and they'll have to take up much more of the court's time. And that results in a taking up of the court and state resources, which this is originally, the statute is originally meant to prevent that from happening. The third point that I want to make, and the final point, is that the result of a dismissal based on statutory speedy trial grounds is one that the result is that it can be reindicted or reissued. So this is not a permanent dismissal. So when the judge, if the judge grants the motion to dismiss based on speedy trial, the district attorney doesn't just lose this case. It doesn't disappear over the edge of the cliff, never to be seen again. If the district attorney wants to, they can reissue or reindict that case. And I think if you spoke with district attorneys, they would often tell you that if they thought they were not going to win this issue, they would come prepared after losing to reissue or reindict at that moment. So this doesn't result in any sort of significant impact the way it is on district attorneys not being able to provide help for the community and the victims involved in these cases. And I'm available to the committee to address any of the things that was that were already previously testified to. I'm happy to answer any questions. Those were our three main issues that we wanted to address this time. Thank you.
Kenny, Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to see trials stretched out as, I mean, like where people are disappearing to the gulag somewhere and never coming up again for years or anything like that, but I think I think what this law is trying to address, maybe you can help me out, is just a little more flexibility. And for example, if a defendant is a no-show and that slows things up for 2 months and you take that 2 months out, but that could really have some kind of a longer effect. It was my experience. Like there'd be a delay in court and then the next time you set the case and then the officer's gone or the witness is in the desert for the winter or something. So then it goes on. So what might be a 60-day delay based on a no-show could really result in months. And so those kind of things I think a court should be allowed to take into consideration, which I think this bill would take care of. In other words, what might be a brief delay on the defendant's part might really result in a longer delay down the road, not intentionally by the defendant, but it just might work out that way. And then as far as cost, it would seem to me that it would cost much more for a district attorney to have to re-indict later on and recharge than to have a hearing to resolve that. I wouldn't think there would be that many of those hearings.
And Chair McPherson, Vice Chair Barker, members of the committee, I have two thoughts on that, and I'll try and make them brief. The first is that the court at this point has the discretion to take those things into consideration. So if I have a defendant X and he fails to appear for 2 months, and we already know they can take that into consideration, and I'm a district attorney and I present to the court, but for this delay on behalf of the defendant, I would have been able to try this case. I believe that the judge has the discretion to take that into consideration and potentially attribute that delay that would have otherwise been attributed to the state to the defendant and subtract that from the time computation. My concern is that the way that this is phrased, and we don't support this, I think, even with amendments, but it, kind of a more abstract sense, that the way this is phrased is that if the defendant willfully failed to appear at any point in the proceeding, meaning that if I fail to appear and I show up, I'm arrested, whatever, the next day, 2 days, that it sounds to me the way this is phrased as if I automatically lose my statutory speedy trial rights. And I don't know if that's the wording, I don't know if that was the intent, but that's a kind of a concerning issue when for one failure to appear, you lose that right. And practically, failure to appear isn't a crime in and of itself. And so what I envision happening is that you would actually have to have a hearing to determine whether or not somebody willfully failed to appear, similar to Representative Barker, as you know, if you had a failure to appear trial, you'd have to have the same thing happen. And I think that that does have some sort of impact. The more hearings, the more time the court needs to take, that does have a negative impact on the court system. Right now, I think they can take into consideration, in my opinion, that they can already take those things into consideration based on the current statute and current case law.
But my concern isn't the 60 days, it's the tumbling effect that might have later down the road, and I don't know how you would prove that. That's why I think the intent of this is to say if somebody doesn't show, then, you know, that comes off the table. But I don't want a speedy trial to be denied for years. I mean, I don't think that's the intent either. But, I mean, I just think that those kind of things that do cause these delays should be looked at without the judge having, I mean, you don't have to have all those hearings. You just say, you know, there was a no-show, therefore we can extend this a bit. But I understand you make a good point. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Barker.
Ms. Alconich, I guess the thing that strikes me about our statutory speedy trial requirement is that I have trouble figuring out whether it's a right for the accused or whether it is simply a matter of the administration of the judicial system. We're not changing, of course, the constitutional right to a speedy trial. That exists and requires a showing of prejudice. So if it's just a question of whether there has to be a re-indictment, which strikes me as something that would, in itself, having to go through a process of having charges dropped and then potentially re-entered a new indictment, it doesn't seem as though that is those are matters of real importance to the rights of the accused. Help me out here. Was this a judicial workflow issue, or is it something that really impacts on defendants?
Representative McPherson, Chair McPherson, members of the committee, I'm kind of two minds in some ways. I feel that this is very much a housekeeping measure, and I can tell you from having practiced in one of the busiest counties, Washington County and Multnomah County, you'll often hear judges working and DAs and defense attorneys working very diligently to move these cases through so nobody is impacted. I think everybody works well together and tries to make sure that statutory speedy trial rights are not violated. I also think that this affects the rights of defendants because if you take away that kind of holding the state's feet to the fire, you have cases that will languish in the system. You just simply do. If you have somebody who's failed to appear, and we could go back and forth and talk about what it means to willfully fail to appear, and I'm just using that as an example, but fails to appear, then there's no statutory speedy trial, then they have to wait till they reach the constitutional speedy trial threshold, which is much, much more difficult to prove and can take much longer. So you impact defendants, let me think of how to exactly phrase this. I think you impact the rights of the accused in addition to getting rid of a housekeeping measure because you take away some of their statutory safeguards in the system. And when you start talking about the constitutional safeguards, you talk about those things like anxiety and concern, loss of job, impact on family when a defendant is pending charges. So the longer case is drawn out, you truly do impact the rights of the accused. Although I think that this actually impacts victims and DAs and the state additionally,
not just the rights of the accused, as I've stated.
Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess it's more of a comment than a question, and the part that concerns me is the delay caused by a lack of judicial resources, such as the unavailability of a judge, from a policy perspective, because I think that the right to a speedy trial is something that everybody understands and the public understands, and I don't think the public understands that there's a distinction between a statutory and a constitutional right to a speedy trial. But my concern is that I think that I don't want to shirk our responsibility as legislators to fund the judicial system. And I remember when all the courts were closed on Friday, and I can understand that that might lead to a concern that perhaps resulted in this provision being in the bill, but I don't want us as legislators to say, well, here's an excuse. I think we need to fund the judicial system so that we don't have to make excuses for not having enough judges to try cases. So that's my concern. Thank you.
Okay, any further questions? Thank you, Ms. Elkonich. I would like to ask Mr. Sylvester to come forward to respond to just one of the points that was made.
Chairman McPherson,
identify yourself again for the record.
Tim Sylvester, Department of Justice.
It was about the modifier substantially prejudiced. I mean, we have a constitutional regime which requires prejudice, and according to Ms. Elkonich, requires the terminology is actual prejudice.
That's
and
correct.
So because the question is, are we setting a higher bar for the speedy trial requirement under this bill if we use substantially?
Well, Chairman McPherson, it would not make any sense to put a higher standard under a statute than is required by the Constitution.
Right.
The statute never could be enforced. And I think the idea here is that substantial prejudice is some standard less than would be required for the defendant to establish in order to get a dismissal under the Constitution. And so all this is intended to say is that the defendant has to show some degree of prejudice. It doesn't have to be as much as would entitle him to a dismissal under the constitutional speedy trial standards, but it would be some degree of prejudice. Under the statute as it currently is written, there is no showing of prejudice that is required at all. And the courts, the Supreme Court decisions that I mentioned earlier essentially say that if there is delay that is unreasonable, there is the case shall be dismissed regardless of whether the defendant has suffered any prejudice at all. And all this is doing is requiring some degree of prejudice to be shown in order to be entitled to a dismissal. Does that answer your question?
It does answer the question.
If I may ask a question, my role is counsel. Mr. Sylvester, is the term substantial prejudice defined?
It is not in this.
Okay.
No. There are plenty of court decisions out there, however, that talk about the word substantial. And I think in the context of statutes and legal opinion, substantial is not the same as what in the normal conversation substantial means. It just means a certain amount, a minimum that demonstrates something beyond, a de minimis amount. And so it is not in the common parlance, substantial means a big amount, but I think in legal standard, substantial just, for example, the standard for proof if I recall correctly, an agency proceeding is some substantial evidence, which just means a minimal number to minimal amount in order to prove a point. And so I think in this context, the word substantially prejudice is not intending to be a large amount of prejudice, but just some degree of prejudice that is more than insignificant.
Thank you.
If there's a comment here while we're still in hearing, we could do that, Representative Bonamici, or...
No, I just wondered if there were more witnesses on this bill.
Oh, I see. We have we just have a couple of minutes left. Why don't we... we have no more witnesses on this bill, so I'm going to close the public hearing. And for purposes of finding out where we are, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2132, before we lose a couple of members here. And what's your pleasure, members? Are you comfortable with the language of the bill as it is? We had an issue with an interchange here just now on the issue, a question of whether the substantially standard is something different from the constitutional standard. Is this an issue people are comfortable moving today?
If I may, Mr. Chair, I'm comfortable with moving it. I think this is acts as a housekeeping. It doesn't attack the constitutional protection for the defendant. A very good point was made, though, that a long process trial does affect the defendant, especially if they're an innocent person who's been charged. But on the whole, we've seen cases dismissed that may have been dismissed a little bit too easily. And I want justice for the victims as well. I think this is a compromise that would work.
I'm not comfortable with it the way it's drafted because of my concern about the judicial resources and substantial. I agree with Representative Barker about the intent, and I'd like to see, I wouldn't want to see the cases languish, but I have concern about the wording.
Are there language changes that would allay that concern, or is it a sort of
probably, but this way. Not off the top of my head.
Right. No, we're not going to make them today. The question is, are we just at a point where there are different differences on the policy, in which case we have to sort of take our shot at it, and that's it, or is it something that where we can resolve that discomfort with amending the language?
I certainly believe it could be resolved with the language.
Okay. Then if it's all, if the members are comfortable with this, I'd like to try and pursue that by with amended language and not try to take it to a vote today. So I will close the work session on House Bill 2132. We are at 10 a.m. and we're going to lose a couple of our members here. We have three more bills set for hearing today. And I think by asking the audience earlier that we had no one who had come from a distance. Ms. Christian?
Mr. Chair, if I could be heard, I've certainly not come from a distance and will be here another day. We do have another individual who's here from Salem, from the Office of Public Defense Services.
If on which bill? On all three of them? Or?
No, simply on 2135.
Why don't we go directly to House Bill 2135, hold a hearing on that then. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2135. Mr. Sylvester, you're up.
Thank you, Chairman McPherson. I do have prepared testimony on this one.
Good morning, Chairman McPherson, members of the committee. Although this bill looks a bit complicated, the issue is relatively simple, and our proposal, I think, is relatively simple. What we have is the vast majority of criminal cases, I think maybe well in excess of 90% of the cases, are resolved by plea agreements, whereby a defendant comes in and pleads guilty or no contest to charges. And frequently what that means is that he or she will plead guilty to some of the charges against him that have been filed, and the DA, the prosecutor, agrees to dismissal of the other charges. Or the defendant will, for example, be charged with murder and agrees to plead guilty to manslaughter as a lesser offense. And sometimes these plea agreements also contemplate that the defendant will, that the DA agrees that there are other charges out there that will not be filed if you plead to this one. Mm-hmm. Or you will have a situation where charges pending in other counties will be dismissed, and so you have a global agreement. That is a very common way of resolving criminal cases. And that's all fine. And the cases that are, the charges that are dismissed or reduced or not filed kind of go away. But the law also provides that there are circumstances in which the plea may be set aside or vacated.
The very statute that allows for a guilty plea, for example, allows the court to allow a defendant to withdraw that guilty plea. Or the defendant may appeal, and he may prevail on appeal, and the case come back and withdraw his guilty plea. Or further on down the road, he may get post-conviction relief or federal habeas corpus relief that will result in the vacation of those guilty pleas and a remand to the trial court. And the assumption always has been for the last 150 years in this state that if a defendant at some point or another repudiates his plea, that is, he goes up on appeal and prevails and comes back and withdraws his guilty plea, or he goes into post-conviction and has his plea vacated and the case is remanded back to the original trial court, that if he repudiates his guilty plea, well, then the state is entitled to repudiate its part of the plea deal and thereby reinstate all the charges that were dismissed, all the charges that were reduced, or all the charges or file the charges that were not filed as a result of the plea agreement. Anyway, that was the assumption that always has been. And then we recently got some decisions out of the Oregon Court of Appeals and the Oregon Supreme Court that is cited there, State versus District. That was a case in which a defendant was charged with a variety of offenses arising out of an accident that she caused while driving drunk, and one of the charges was manslaughter, and there was some assault and DUI charges too. And as part of the plea agreement in that case, that if I recall correctly, she pleaded guilty to criminally negligent homicide. The state dismissed the other charges, and she appealed and prevailed and came back and withdrew her guilty plea to the criminally negligent homicide. And the trial and the prosecutor said, well, in light of her withdrawal of the plea that was part of the plea bargain, we want the rest of the charges reinstated. The trial court agreed, reinstated all the charges, and she was tried and found guilty of all the charges. And she appealed, and the Oregon Court of Appeals in that case said no, the trial court had no authority to reinstate the charges that were dismissed as part of the plea bargain. And we appealed that and took it up to the Oregon Supreme Court, and the Oregon Supreme Court affirmed, although on slightly different grounds. And so the current state of the law is such that what we are afraid of is that now any time a defendant enters into a plea agreement with the state by which he or she agrees to plead to one charge or to reduce charge and the state dismisses the others, that the state will not be entitled to have those charges reinstated if for some reason in the future that plea is either set aside or vacated. And so what these various provisions do in House Bill 2135 is grant specific statutory authority for the trial court in such a circumstance to reinstate the charges if the defendant repudiates the plea deal and vacates or has his or her pleas vacated in some collateral proceeding. So Section 1 adds a new section to 135.365 that allows the trial court to reinstate charges if the defendant withdraws his or her guilty plea. Section 2 of that amends a statute in the Post-Conviction Hearing Act, and this new statute in the Post-Conviction Hearing Act will provide, no, excuse me, 138.240 is the statute that governs direct appeals. And it provides that if the appellate court reverses the judgment and remands, and that will have the effect of allowing the defendant to withdraw or invalidate a guilty plea, that the trial court on remand from the appellate court will have the authority to reinstate the charges. Section 3 of the bill amends the Post-Conviction Hearing Act. That's 138.520. And this also provides that if a post-conviction court vacates a defendant's or petitioner's guilty plea, for example, that he or she was not provided adequate assistance by counsel or that the guilty plea that was entered was not sufficiently knowing and voluntary, and the post-conviction court remands the case to the trial court, the trial court on remand will be able to reinstate the original charges against the defendant. Section 4 on the next page, this one is a bit complicated, but Section 4 and Section 5 deal with the situation in which charges have either not been filed or have been reduced. And so if the defendant
withdraws a guilty plea or has it vacated and some period of time has elapsed, there may be a statute of limitations problem that has been created in the interim, or there may be an argument that the defendant's conviction on some charges in that same case will be a double jeopardy bar to re-prosecution of the charges that were dismissed. Well, Section 4 eliminates the statutory double jeopardy bar, and Section 5 provides that if there was one of these situations and after the plea has been vacated and the state wants to reinstate the charges but the statute of limitations has expired in the interim, the state still will be able to file those charges. I'll give you an example of a situation that created a problem for us, and it ended up not being a problem because we ultimately won the issue on appeal. But there was many years ago, there was a serial rapist in the Multnomah County area and committed perhaps dozens of break-in rape sort of situations. And he was caught, and he eventually pleaded out, I think, to two or three charges. And the state, there was a whole bunch of other charges that were filed against him in Multnomah County and other counties. And as part of this overall plea agreement, the state agreed to dismiss all of these charges and not to file a whole bunch of other charges that potentially could have been filed against him. Well, so he was convicted. He was sentenced off to prison essentially for a life term. And years later, he ended up in federal court and challenged his guilty plea. And the federal trial court, the federal district court, vacated his plea, saying that his trial counsel had provided constitutionally inadequate assistance. And so the court had vacated all his pleas to those charges. And so at that point, the DA in Multnomah County, I think Washington, Clackamas County, and maybe even over in Clark County, was scrambling around to see if they could, because one of the problems is that the cases that he was convicted on may no longer be prosecutable because the victims had disappeared in the interim, a 10-year interim. And so they were scrambling around to try to find some of the victims for the other cases that had been dismissed. But because those cases had been dismissed long, long ago, the statute of limitations had expired in the interim in these cases. And so what we were afraid of is that as a result of this, if this case was going to come back, we might not be able to retry this guy on anything. Fortunately, we took that case up on appeal and prevailed in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and ultimately his convictions were upheld. But that is the sort of situation that creates a problem here, is that defendant pleads guilty pursuant to an agreement by which the state dismisses some charges, agrees not to file others. Time goes on, and then eventually he goes through a post-conviction or federal habeas corpus proceeding and manages to invalidate his guilty plea or to get a remand to vacate his, or to withdraw his guilty plea. And if the court does that, in the meantime, all the other case charges that were dismissed, can we get those reinstated? And rather than deal with that uncertainty under the current state of the law in Dinsmore, what we are proposing here is a statute, enactment of a series of statutes that makes very clear from now on that if you have this sort of situation and the defendant vacates or withdraws his guilty plea or has it vacated, the answer is you go back to the status quo ante, you go back, and the trial court in that original case has the authority to reinstate all the charges that were dismissed or reduced. And that's just from our standpoint, is just simple, basic fairness. That's the deal. If you're going to plead guilty to these and we're going to dismiss these, if you vacate your guilty plea, we get to reinstate them. And that's the basic premise of this bill. Unless the members of the committee have any questions, I have nothing further.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sylvester, a quick clarification. I heard you talking about using language about we get to reinstate. And I just noticed this may be my own naivete on this, that the language says the court shall reinstate. Is there any situation where the state might not want to reinstate?
Chairman McPherson, Representative Reed, there may be circumstances in which the state does not want to reinstate. I mean, sometimes you have situations in which we dismiss the charges simply because we realize that they are not prosecutable. New evidence comes up and they're not prosecutable, or for whatever reason the state may not decide to pursue those particular charges. And if that is the case, then the state would not assert the right under these provisions to
to require the court to reinstate them. But the point is basically that if the plea deal is undone and the case comes back to the trial court, on the request of the state that particular charges shall be reinstated, the court has no discretion but to reinstate those.
Thank you.
Other questions for Mr. Sylvester?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Mark Brown from OCDLA.
Good morning, Chairman McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Mark Brown. I'm an attorney with Legal Services Division and adjunct professor at Washington State University in Vancouver, but today I'm testifying on behalf of OCDLA. And this House Bill 2135 is being dubbed the Dinsmore fix based on the Dinsmore case that Mr. Lester noted. Dinsmore actually, what Dinsmore held, and as happens often, I'm reading it a little differently than the Department of Justice. Dinsmore, in my reading, holds that the terms of the agreement indicate whether the charges that were dismissed can be reinstated. And if I may quote from Dinsmore, the state's second argument that reinstatement of all the charges against defendants simply restores the status quo ante following defendants' repudiation of the agreement is similarly unavailing. The status quo ante of the party's relationship in this case was defined by the terms of the party's agreement, and defendant fully has performed her end of the bargain. So the court's really saying that we have an agreement set and the terms of the agreement dictate what can happen in the future if this is remanded. Now really what this goes to, I think, is conditional guilty pleas. If someone enters into a guilty plea based on the statutory authority, it can only be remanded for resentencing. So there wouldn't really be an issue of reinstating charges. But with a conditional guilty plea, a person can enter into a guilty plea but reserve the right to appeal a specific issue. So if there was a search and seizure issue that was denied on pretrial, the individual, the defendant, can enter a conditional guilty plea reserving the right to appeal that. If they win that, it's then remanded for whatever reason, in this case would be to on the search and seizure issue. So we're talking about conditional guilty pleas. A conditional guilty plea was proposed in 1999 by the criminal law section of the Oregon State Bar and was passed at that time. The fundamental idea behind the legislation was to reduce the expenditure of judicial resources. Prior to that, when such a situation arose, a defendant would enter into, or a defendant state would do a stipulated facts trial where they agree to the facts to convict, and as a result they have a conviction. It's not a guilty plea, so they can then appeal any issue from that case, pretrial issue or otherwise. My fear, reading through this bill, is that it's going to undercut the concept of the conditional guilty plea, because in this case criminal defendants will be less willing to enter these pleas when the charges can be reinstated, so they may default back to just doing a stipulated facts trial. This provision, this bill, would not cover a stipulated facts trial because it's technically not a guilty plea. You're not pleading guilty, you're having a trial before the court. So it'll undo sort of what this committee and what the legislature tried to do in 99, which was to reduce the costs involved with these conditional guilty pleas. It's also, and this is what confused me about it, it seems to be one less bargaining chip. When plea negotiations occur, there's lots of bargaining chips that go on between the prosecutors and the defendants, one of which could be and has been, if you agree to this, we will agree to dismiss these charges and we won't reinstate them, or we will reinstate them. That's a bargaining chip. As Dinsmore said, it's the terms of the agreement that dictate what happens on remand. And so it seems to be that it's taking away a bargaining chip from the prosecutors which might result in fewer guilty pleas, fewer no contest pleas, which will mean more trials. So what it'll do is add to the judicial workload, add to the length trials take because of judicial resources. So really, again, going back to the conditional guilty plea, it was designed to streamline these situations. And by proposing this bill, it seems like it will do away with this conditional guilty plea. It seems to be, as I said, a resolution to a problem that doesn't really exist, that the problem isn't really there right now, and there doesn't seem to be a resolution. One note on what Mr. Sylvester was talking about, that he was noting, and Representative Reed pointed this out, he was noting that the bill gave the prosecutor the option, or gave the, I think he said, the court the authority to reinstate the charges, but it does actually say the court shall reinstate charges. Mr. Sylvester, to respond to Representative Reed, said that in some cases a prosecutor may not choose to, but this doesn't give the court discretion not to. It says the court shall reinstate, so you'll have to have the court reinstate the charges, at which time the prosecutor will say, we're dismissing the charges, and we'll have to have a hearing on this, and the charges will be dismissed. So again, adding to this cost involved on these cases, it's a problem that doesn't exist, and that seems to be adding to costs and time on these cases. So that is my... Oh, and one last note, that perhaps this bill should be reviewed by the criminal law section of the bar, being that it seems to affect the conditional guilty plea, which was proposed by the criminal law section. So I have no further testimony.
Representative Barker.
This seems to me, Mr. Brown, that the what this is trying to do is say you get one bite at the apple. And being an old union negotiator, you know, we would try to straighten things out that way. I go in and cut a deal that I'm going to take a plea on one rape case and you're going to dismiss five. Mm-hmm. And then because I have a search issue on the one, I get to walk. And that doesn't seem right to me. I think that the state should be able to reinstate, and the fact that the court shall reinstate may be addressing some skepticism. I don't know what the intent is, but I can see where it would be a good idea to order the courts to reinstate, and then if there's, you know, then the DA could dismiss or not. But if you allow them to maybe reinstate, then some judge may on his own or her own, for whatever reason, not reinstate, and that would be a real problem. So to me, this seems to be a reasonable fix. I understand what you're saying, and it probably will affect some of the people saying, well, I don't want to take that plea if I can't have another shot. But if I agree, if I'm the defendant, and I agree to take a hit as long as you let go all this other stuff that's hanging out there, and then I try to come back, it's like, to me, they're weaseling on an agreement, and... I think this is a good bill from my point of view. So thank you, though, for your testimony. I think you did your explanation.
Okay. I give you an opportunity to respond if you but don't feel obliged to.
No. Thank you, Representative or Chairman McPherson, Representative Barker. Those are good points. I think getting at your first point, it's all in a well-crafted plea agreement. So if it specifically says, you know, in black and white, the prosecutor reserves the right to reinstate any charges dismissed, I think that could take care of the problem. And it gives the prosecutors the ability to use it as a bargaining chip. And so I think if the prosecutor does want to have the option to reinstate the charges, that needs to be in the plea agreement. And for Dinsmore, the way I read Dinsmore, that would be fine. That's how I would get around that.
Okay, I'm not an attorney, so I don't know.
No.
The reading of Dinsmore, that where I could guess that a judge might say, well, because of Dinsmore, you don't get a second shot. And I'm also worried about this being used where a defendant, through a bright lawyer, might see this as a way to set this up to get something dismissed and get somebody, and I understand defense attorneys, and I mean, I understand that the whole part of the Constitution, and I appreciate that, and it's vitally needed, but I don't want to see the system manipulated. So thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Thank you.
Although we retain a quorum, our numbers are sufficiently diminished, I think, that we will not take this bill to a work session. So we'll close the work session on House Bill 2135, and we will set over House Bills 2133 and 2138 with apologies to anyone who was had hoped to appear on those today. We'll get them rescheduled. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.